Hello, everyone. Sorry, I'm loud. Okay, let's go ahead and get started. My name is Sabelle Knowles. I'm the events coordinator here at the Poetry Center, and I'm happy to welcome you to the Poetry Center, or back, as the case may be, if you were here last night, and I know very many of you were. Just want to thank you, Franz, for coming all the way to Arizona to give a fantastic reading. It was really wonderful.
Thank you.
I don't really think Franz Wright needs any introduction at this point, but I'll just say a few quick words. He's a poet. He's a translator. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner. He won the Pulitzer for his 2003 collection, Walking to Martha's Vineyard. And another wonderful writer named Janice Johnson has said of Franz's poems, "They're like tiny jewels shaped by blunt, ruined fingers, miraculous gifts." I love that. So thank you for coming, and we're going to just take questions. And if you could do me a favor and speak your questions into the mic, we're recording this Q&A session for posterity, and your question will get onto the tape if it goes through the mic. So I'll run around and pass this about.
What sense do you make of Rilke now? Have you changed your feelings about him? Sometimes he seems like ponderous, like Rodin to me now.
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's true. I have, he seems, and sometimes he almost seems to me like one of those, there are certain writers, he's not really, but there are certain writers that I think appeal to younger people, and adolescents, and the adolescent in everyone, and he's a borderline. I mean, of course, he's a very, you know, it doesn't mean, well, there are very major writers that could be said of, you know, and it's a wonderful sort of form, you know, writings for younger people, but I just think that I felt very differently, I felt very differently about everything. I think I had an exaggerated idea of, I see better what's strong in him and what doesn't work as well. And I like his work that is, my favorite work of his is the middle sort of period, Neue Gedichte, New Poems. The really crystalline, sharp poems that often have to do with, well, his idea was, he was kind of stuck. He was like Yeats. He began writing in a much more flowery sort of 19th century romantic way, and then he was dissatisfied with that, and he became one of the, I guess he could be called a kind of modernist. My favorite work of his, I know what happened. He went to Paris to become, when he was still probably in his late 20s or 30, Rodin secretary, and which would sound like a pretty good job. And but he did it for a while, and then he, being Rilke, he, you know, it didn't last very long. He wanted, you can't have two major, like two guys who want to be the, I mean, he had great reverence for him. What he learned from him was, I think it was Rodin who told him, you know, you've written enough about you've looked inward enough. What you need to look outward and go look at, you need to think about, it's interesting, sort of like the concept that the Japanese haiku poets had and some of the Chinese, the Tang Dynasty poets, too. If you look outward, like he would tell him to go to the zoo, like go write a poem about, you know, an animal or something. He did write the panther, which to this day all German children learn in school, and that's the only, and the idea was, somewhat like Eliot's objective correlative. You know, if you, instead of saying straight out saying something about the way you feel, you talk about the way you feel by describing something outside yourself, and the way you speak about it will will, in an unspoken way, you'll be talking about the way you feel. And that was the when you start getting the real Rilke. And then he had different styles. Some of them are much like the later Elegies and the Sonnets to Orpheus. And I translated for a long time his unfinished sort of fragmentary work that he did while he was trying to write the Elegies, trying to find a vocabulary and a style for the Elegies, and that work interests me very much. But he was like the poet, you know, what a poet is, and I don't, you know, he's still a poet I love very much, but I don't have the same kind of, you know, worshipful, you know, like, attitude about it.
Last night, I think for a while there, you were talking about channeling William Burroughs, and you know, within your work that I heard, you know, there's a lot of different voices, a lot of different characters. Do you find yourself when you're composing? Do you find yourself adopting like a persona? You become someone else in order to deliver the, you know, what would be your real authentic emotions, but perhaps create a different situation in which to present them.
Yeah, and you do that. Baudelaire's idea was that that's the very first thing a poet needs to do is create a persona. And you're always doing it. It's confusing, I think, because I also mentioned that lyric poetry, you speak in the first person, everyone assumes that you're speaking literally about yourself all the time. Whereas in fiction, we accept the idea that it might be made up. You know, it might be something made up in order to tell a higher kind of truth. You know, and I feel like free to make things up, even though I'm speaking in the first person in a poem. And but I think every poem you write, you are looking for a different mask. I know what happened to me. In the last couple of years, the reason I was able to write this book of prose that I've been trying to finish is that I had always told this to students, you know, I had the idea that, and I tried to do it when I was younger. If you find that you're really good at one particular thing, then focus on what you're not good at, you know, and it makes something happens where the work becomes fuller and more human. And for me, you know, it was enough image. The image was, you know, very important to me. And then I tried to learn more about technical things about sound, music, of musical aspect of poetry. And then what helped me with the prose was I realized I had spent a lot of time reading, you know, theater kind of stuff. And my favorite playwright is Harold Pinter, and his work strikes me almost as kind of prose poems sometimes in an odd way. But the idea, a lot of reading in Beckett and Pinter and other playwrights, but not just them, you know, Eugene O'Neill I like very much, and, you know, like that. And going back to the Greek playwrights. And I found out in these prose pieces that these other parts of myself could come out and talk. And sometimes several of them come out and talk to each other. And they have a conversation. And it's not a conversation, it's a conflicting. They're conflicting with each other. It's like a sort of dissonance. So that was what turned out to be the thing I needed to concentrate on, the thing I was weaker at. And then once I realized I could do that, I could put that together with the lyrical qualities of writing, then I got something, I don't know how successful it is, but it was so much more satisfying to me. I felt this, I had a feeling I'd never had of of something was lifted off of me. I felt lighter, and yeah.
Thank you.
So when you begin writing and you're aware of needing to adopt a persona, are you often already connected to the emotions you want to get at and you find the right voice? Or do you start with voice hoping to be able to connect to something and get more clear about what you're feeling about the subject?
I always start from language. I've never, ever once started written anything with a pre-meditated or a pre-conceived subject. Like, I'm going to write something about this, so I'm going to write something. I tried when I was young, and it never worked. It was too conscious. It was too wooden and kind of stiff. And what I do is just keep what I know lots of writers do, and I... For me, what's always worked, and it's something, if a younger writer asks me, I always suggest this. I find myself saying this. Never sit down with the idea that you are going to write a finished piece of work. It can happen, rarely. But to get depth and space in a piece of writing, I believe that you can go too far, but I remember saying to a teacher of mine, David Young, I always cultivate the deliberate unconsciousness of subject material. And David said, maybe you should cultivate a little bit more consciousness. And he was right. If you do one thing, then try to do the opposite to balance it and get it more whole. So I needed to do that. I needed to become more conscious. But what works for me is I have the habit of listening in on... Everyone has this, I think Breton called it, the incessant murmur of language flowing through them. You hear it sometimes when you're going to sleep, this almost stream of that's separate from your conscious control of your mind. It's right under... You can hear it sometimes, snatches of it. It's this flowing underneath consciousness, this stream of just blah, 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 like different words coming from your memory and from your imagination and your hopes. And if you train, I've trained myself, that's what the first piece I read, I think, that there's an untitled prologue at the beginning of the prose book, which is about that, listening. And writing is paying attention and listening. And they're two different things. Listening is patience and waiting, and listening in on your own. You have this inner. We all talk to ourselves, as you're walking along, or when you're alone, especially, and mainly when you're alone, you can hear it more clearly. And I would find that in a certain mood, in the right mood. That I would be listening to that inner conversation, it would suddenly become the language would start to become heightened and more interesting, and then I would go there. And I wouldn't start there. I would wait for a while. I wouldn't immediately. As soon as you start to write, everything changes. It's almost as if your unconscious sort of withdraws, like it conceals itself again. And I would wait and write something largely in my mind first. Before I went to go, because your mind goes, oh, he's got a pen in his hand and he's ready now. We're gonna shut down. You get very inhibited. You get self-conscious. So I would wait. I get a good line or a couple lines, and I go, okay. And I'd wait before writing them down. I often do this while I'm walking and somewhere where there's no people and. I'd wait and see what would come next, if something was going to come next. And often it would. It would suggest something else, and then something else. Then at a certain point when I thought, all right, I've got enough material that I'm not going to be able to remember it all, I would start writing. And then the act of writing, you feel confident because you already have this start, this material. So you don't feel as inhibited, and you feel confident. And then each thing will suggest something else, and it just starts to roll, you know, along. You know, and then you get a draft of something, and I never try to write. It happens that I write finished things without revising them, but very seldom. To me, I would say writing is revision. It's like sculpting. It's something you get a draft, and it's like a block of material that you can sculpt something out of, or it's a canvas, you know, it's like, so, and I write things 50 times often. And now I have a new trick I've learned, which works magically. I wish I had not stumbled on this sooner, where I'll take a poem or a prose piece that I consider to be finished. It's finished. Can't do any more. And I'll take a notebook or a piece of paper, and I'll copy it out by hand, slowly. I even have a brush I use that slows me down even more. It's like it's a part half pen, half paintbrush, and it's like a calligraphy kind of brush. And I'll do it in print and that slows it down. And the more slowed down it is, the more meditative it becomes. You forget. Your attention again turns outward rather than inward, and so when your attention turns outward, those voices can start welling up, you know. I'll think something is absolutely finished, and I'll copy it out by hand and find 7-8 places that I go, how did I not see that this could be made so much better? This could be said in so much better way, you know. So the revision process, I continue to do it for a very, very long time before I consider, you know, something finished. I know that now, and that was hard to accept for a while, but now I love it. I love that process, you know, because you have something that's pretty finished, and then it gets even a little better, you know, and it's a wonderful feeling. You know? It's like someone came up and said, pointing, when, you know, it's like you have this inner... Writing is, in a way, it is splitting yourself into the person writing and the person watching and going, no, that's like another person, a critic or an editor. If you're your own critic, your own editor as much as possible, then you can take it farther. You know? But still, that also brings up the necessity for me, and I think, I don't know any writers who don't have a few people they show things to. Well, of course, you have an editor. And I'm blessed with a particularly brilliant one, Deborah Garrison at Knopf, who's just the most phenomenal. Like, there's a kind of ESP that we've developed where she'll say something, she's so tactful, and she doesn't, you know, want me to get upset. Because she knows that I can get to, I go, what? Like, no, I'm not going to change, you know, so she's like, what am I, you know, she won't bring up everything at once. She'll just touch on something enough so that it gets in my head and I think about it over a few days and then I start going, oh, I see. And then often this will happen. It just happened recently. She'll say, you know, I felt that the previous version of this was maybe better. And I thought, no, this one's so much better. Then I thought about it and I went, wait. The earlier one's ending was better. I need to get the ending and somehow graft it onto this longer, fuller piece. And then I did that. I wrote to her and I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sort of think about what you said by taking the ending from the other one, the previous one, and trying to get it onto this. And she immediately wrote back and she goes, she said it's uncanny because that was exactly what I was going to suggest. So we've gotten to a point where we read each other's, we know each other's, you know, how we work pretty well. And my wife is really good at it. Like, part of revision is reading something out loud to her. And she has that same ability to go, to not just come down on you with, this is bad, they get it, like... She has a way of also saying, it's really good, Franz, really good, and building you up, and then, but, you know, like this. Because I'm very insecure and vain, and they're trying to, like, ruin my writing, you know. So I have her, and I have several writer friends that I send things to, and I get all their suggestions all together, and then I choose from the ones that. And again, one of the few times I've taught, haven't not very often, but I always say, you got to shake this thing, which you have really strongly when you're young, which is no one's going to. This is like sacred; you can't change a word of it. And you got to realize, no, it's not. It's good to have. The wonderful thing is that you can go on and sharpening it like a blade. You can sharpen it till there's no blade, you know, anymore. You can like, so you got to know when to stop. You start going really, you know, as you want to. This is something Charles Simic said to me. I've been blessed with some really, really good teachers, or not. They weren't teachers, but writers I corresponded with and that mentored me in a way when I was younger. And he said, you have to leave something a little rough in front. He goes, you're trying too hard. The lyrical absolute, he used that too. You're trying to make it too perfect. And a little roughness makes it poignant, human, you know. And it's like that Islamic thing about where they leave a flaw, you know. So, because, and there are, that idea is different. It's showing, it's like not falling prey to hubris, to thinking you're the, you know, the way that we're made in the image of God is that we can make something out of nothing, you know. Well, it's not like we look like, you know, that's what I think. We can do a little tiny, in a small way, we can make something that didn't exist before. That's like fabulous. And René Char has the most beautiful phrase in the world about that. He said, the poem, or a work of art of any kind is a gift of the creature to the, no, a contribution of the creature to the creation. It's perfect, you know.
Thank you. That was so generous. Thank you.
Franz, could you talk a little about your translation? What motivates you to translate if you're bilingual in the language that you translate, and just in general, comments on translation?
Yeah, I don't.
What you get out of it?
I don't anymore. I stopped really doing it quite a while ago. I think I did it a lot between the ages of about 15 and 30, and a lot. And first of all, the first impulse was that I wasn't thinking about translation. I was thinking about how to read a poem in another language more closely, and with more comprehension. And to begin to try to translate it is to do that, because you immediately start having to make your own choices about how you're going to do this. And pretty soon you're kind of in the mind of the writer. You're not only understanding the poem better and the different levels of meaning, but you're starting to see into the process itself how the writer arrived at certain, you know, things that seem very mysterious. So for me, it first started out as a way to read better in another language. And then once I got going translating, and I started pretty early, my father, I think the idea was that it would make, there was a time, you probably might remember in the 60s, Hermann Hesse became this huge, he was rediscovered and was hugely like a rock star, Hermann Hesse. Like, those books sold like hundreds of thousands of copies of novels. And so he moved over to Forresthaus and Drew, and his editor there, one of them, Michael DeCapo, asked him if he would, because they were having so much success with Hermann Hesse's novels, they said, why not try to translate some of his poems, which are not great poems, but some of them are very beautiful and very nice. And so we did one that was called Wanderung, or Wandering or Traveling, and that Hesse wrote literally. But, and he knew this, of course, I realize now. Basho had this, created almost this form where you, while going on foot, traveling long distances, and And this is what I mean about walk. There's something about walking where your mind becomes still, and it's, the chattering slows down, and it becomes kind of still, and voices can kind of well up without your willing them to. And sometimes they're very interesting. And so Basho had this style, which is very touching. He would talk about some interesting thing that had happened to him the day while he was walking somewhere. And then he would talk about the situation he was in, then give you the poem he wrote as a result of it. And Hesse did this with a book called Wandering. I think it's still in print. I think it is. Where he would write a prose piece, not really a prose poem, but a kind of dialogue or travel log or something. He'd describe some things he saw. He had been kind of booted out of Germany somehow for pacifist activities around the First World War. So he walked over the Alps, into Switzerland from Italy to into Switzerland or something, and he walked into Italy to get out of. He walked from Germany to Italy, and partly with this in mind that he would have it would give him ideas for things to write. So he'd write a prose piece, and then they even included some of his little watercolors from little places he saw in Italy, and then he'd write a poem. Then he'd have a poem. And my dad did the prose parts, and I did the poems. And the poems are not very good, but they're like little songs, and they're lovely in German. They're very hard to get in English because so much of them. It's a little bit like when you hear a song you really like, and then you just write the lyrics down, and it's like doesn't make it. It's because it's the music and the words that. So you almost feel with some of these poems that if there were music, it would be better. But so they're not that great. But, I was like 17 or something, so that was like exciting. And I think the idea was that that would help me pay my tuition at Oberlin when I went to school. Okay, and it did all right, like, because they, we would get, there'd be a royalty check, and we'd split it. And it would be a lot of money, like it would be like $800, which in 1972 was a lot of money. Like I got one, I remember giving a friend $100 and he'd some money, and my rent was like, $45 a month, whatever. And living on, being able to live on it over the summer and just write, So it was great. And then my dad did one that was just poems. It's much better. That's a great book. Just Hermann Hesse's poems. It's one of those rare cases where the translation is better than the original. They are. I mean, his translations are better than the original poem. That doesn't happen too much. The other case I can think of is maybe Baudelaire translating Edgar Allan Poe. The French loved Edgar Allan Poe. And it's easy to see why, because he had this regular, this very regular, long, like the Raven, da-da-da-da-da, it's the same rhythm over and over again, and the French like that, because they have a longer line than they think more in terms of a long, the iambic pentameter line, which is the basic line in English, is a longer line, I think, in French. Of course, Baudelaire's translations of Poe were going to be better than Poe's poems, because he's like infinitely better poet. But that doesn't necessarily mean it, but sometimes it happens. I've had that, it's an uncanny thing when it happens. I've had the experience of, frankly, even with some of the very minor poems of Rilke, where suddenly I'll look at a line and I'll go, it's better. Just by accident, like I stumbled on something that's really like better. It's got a bigger meaning, more levels of meaning. I forget what we're talking about now, but...
Are you bilingual?
No, I don't really. I would not be able to at this, if ever. I guess I could speak German sort of when I was a kid, but no. I mean, I've translated a lot from French and German, but I don't really speak them very well. I found I had a knack for it. I get a dictionary, and I just sort of start. Sometimes I would look at other translations to see if I get a literal sense of what was happening. And I go, I know I can do better than that. And or I'd get somebody fluent. This is Pound's idea. You get one great way of translating is to get one person's a poet, and then you have someone who's fluent in the language, and they work together. And that's an exciting way to go about it. So sometimes that worked. But I would do it by myself, and I would show them sometimes to... like René Char, very difficult poets. I just found that I had an intuition about it. I would just kind of, even if I didn't fully understand, I remember Thomas Tranströmer saying that he, at one point, he got interested in Whitman so much and he tried to translate him. No, he would read him and he knew he was reading him incorrectly, but his interpretation of what he thought he saw, because a poet will, like, we're like, we're so in the habit of thinking that way in language in that way, and he would know it was incorrect, but it would be a good line, so he would use it in his own poems. That's interesting. But no, I just found out I could do it. I would show it to a fluent French speaking person, say, and they go, it's fine, and I go, they went, so your French is very good. And I go, no, it's not. I don't know French at all. You know, like, hardly at all. German I know pretty well.
Just a quick question.
What do you make of translations of your stuff?
Oh, it's so exciting when that happens. And I've had a woman at Amherst College, a wonderful young French professor, translated all of Walking to Martha's Vineyard into French, and I've seen poems of mine translated into Spanish, German, Vietnamese. On the internet, I've come across sites where people, like, there's a Vietnamese site, that's, like, cool. A guy started writing to me from Iran, and he's studying, of all things, like, in Tehran, he's studying at the University of American Literature. we corresponded a lot, and we like, it was fun. Like, we said, and it was a while ago, so we said some things we might not say now, you know, like, and we each had a few words to say about our own governments, you know, like, and that he might, I mean, at least he might not want to say now. Like, you can say anything here. That's the genius of the system here. Let everyone just say whatever they want, and it completely ignore them. You know, it's great. It's freedom of speech. Freedom of speech. You know, it's like, it's. I almost sometimes think that maybe the Russians had, like, they would, like, sort of kill their poets when they, like, when they got out of line and under Stalin, and maybe that, like, gives them more power. Certainly gives them more power. It's discovered again that language is subversive and dangerous, you know, like, and ideas are the beginning of the first step towards, you know, dangerous developments. And maybe, but I think it's absolutely ingenious, the idea of freedom of speech, because it diffuses rather than language is diffused, its power is diffused in a way. You can say any damn thing you want. It's not going to do any good. Like, they're not going to. They don't care what you say. Say whatever you want.
Franz, I'd like to ask you about one of the epigraphs in your most recent book, Wheeling Motel. Marguerite Yourcenar's, the quote from her, maybe I'll read it so everyone has it in their mind. He had reached that moment in life, different for each one of us, when a man abandons himself to his demon or to his genius, following a mysterious law which bids him either to destroy or outdo himself.
Those are Roman, you know, it's the memoirs of Hadrian, and a book that I cannot recommend to. So I when I found this book, I thought it was among the very greatest books I'd ever read. I read it 10 times, and I can't I really didn't want to start reading it over again. She's a very great writer, and that, not always, but that book is, God, what a masterpiece. But those are Roman concepts. So the one's genius and one's demon. You know, like your genius, I suppose, is the sort of nobler and better side of your nature and your soul. And everyone has one. It's not like, doesn't mean what we, the way we use it, genius. And your demon being your more self-destructive or wilder, or more animal-like side of yourself. And we're, of course, all human beings are, you know, we're always trying to kind of subdue that other destructive part in ourselves and try to transform it into something higher, you know, and we hope to, and sometimes we succeed and sometimes we don't, but what is it that about that quote that you're asking? I just thought, to me it meant, you know, I mean, it seems self-evident to me. I thought it was so wonderful because,
yeah, it's,
you know,
beautiful.
You're in your sort of 50s and you go, well, you know, it's a point where I think poets in our culture, they do tend to start to repeat themselves or do start producing kind of paler versions of poems they did better, you know, or something. And I really was interested in consciously trying not to let that happen and trying to go farther. And I'm not sure it's so evident in that book, but it's going to it's going to be evident in this new one, this prose one. It'll be the one thing, one nasty thing they won't be able to say is that I just sound like my older, you know, work, because it doesn't, and it's really different. But that's all, you know. I think in middle age, you know, and advanced middle age, you know, you're faced with this. You're like, am I really gonna do anything better than I've done? Is there any point even in going through this hell, you know, that you go through? Like when you write a book, I mean, you just, once you're into it, I mean, it just, for me anyway, I take it too hard, you know, it kind of takes over. I remember my father saying, he was at a party somewhere, and he was sort of sulking, and he was depressed about something, and Kenneth Rexroth came over to him and said, "Jip," he goes, "the problem with you is you worry too much about poetry." He says, "Poetry is the work of a pastime of a gentleman and us, you know, and a book person, and it shouldn't be so, if you make it like everything, it's just gonna, you know." And then my dad asked him, Kenneth, "Why do you write poetry?" And he responded immediately with a rather crude, in a rather crude way that was interesting. I don't know if I should say it, but his response was to fuck women and undermine the capitalist system. He said, you know, you got to have like some other reason besides, you know, and then it frees your, you know, frees your creativity. But you do, you find yourself, should I even bother? I feel right now, I'm at this other point where I feel, I don't know, I wrote this book in 1 year, and well, it has happened, I wrote The Before Life in 1 year, but this is a much bigger deal, and I don't, I know I can't go through this again. I know I can't. Not for a very long time, if ever. Because I'm done, man. I'm like so mentally, you know, wasted, like just nothing left. I find now I'm having a great time going back and rewriting things, you know, it's like, I have one more I have to write. It's just, I keep putting it off. It's like the old, I like fleeing from it and putting it off. And whereas while I was in the middle of working on these, I was writing several of them a week, you know, and I wrote well over, you know, I wrote well over 100 of them in a year, so I was at least writing two a week. And I was writing several at the same time, you know, I couldn't stop. It was a big sort of river of stuff, and it's I'm pretty much out of gas now, and I feel kind of resentful about it sometimes. I never get to enjoy anything that any accomplishment or anything that I do that I think is good, pretty good, because I'm immediately in the middle of the frustrations of working on another one, and so I never get this sense of accomplishment. It's never, you know, and I almost feel like, you know, I got this book of prose, I got a new book of poems at the same time that I wrote, and how this happened, I do not know, but it did, and I've shown them to, I go, this can't be, I must be deluding myself, and I've shown them to people who tell me the truth, and they go, no, it's pretty good, and some of it is some of your best stuff, and so I was really, it's like gambling or something, maybe it would be good to like quit while you're on, you know, before you start doing that thing where you start to lose, and then you panic and you lose everything. And that, I mean, that wouldn't happen. But I mean, I just feel tired, and I feel like it's killing me, like really. And it pisses me off. Like I feel like I've been doing this since for 40 years, you know. And don't people retire after like? Certain, like, why not, you know, like, but my wife goes, sure you will, friends, sure you'll stop, like, what will you do then, because I don't, it's like, I don't really, that it scares me, because it's the only time I really feel good, it's the only time I feel happy, it's when I'm working, it drives me out of my mind, but when it's going well, it's the only time I really feel like myself, you know, so I don't know what to do, what's going to happen. Yeah, you. Oh, okay. We'll get you.
You know, Kenneth Burke says poems are instruments, practical instruments for living. That's the way I experience your stuff. I mean, it's like a flashlight or a bad night or energy.
That's not how I experience it, though.
Oh, I want to just sort of tell you just thank you.
Oh,
they've been like a
thank you.
Big.
That's, oh, well, that's...
Last night, and I thought, wow, I could have used this.
That's a wonderful thing. That's a wonderful thing to hear. And I always, you know what, the reason that's so wonderful to hear is that's what poetry meant to me when I was young. Like, it meant, it saved me. I would find, oh, someone else has felt this, has experienced this, and found a way to express it, and something in me, and that's the greatest thing. And then if you find that you can do that, you've done that for somebody else. You just gave me, you know, that's the greatest payment, greatest gift that for writing that a writer could hear. You know, because that's I think why writers start, because they want to do that. What writing does to them. Thank you. Did you wanted to say something, right?
Well, I now have a new question in relation to his. So what do you feel when you reread your poetry, if you ever do?
I don't really. I don't look back. I'm afraid that it will. It's a distraction from writing new ones, and I look at them when I'm going to give a reading. Sometimes, I really don't. Because sometimes they embarrass me very much. And sometimes, and then when I know they're good, the few that I really feel I know are good, they don't, they're not alive to me the same way anymore. It's what's alive for me is what I'm working on now, you know, like that's what's getting, you know, keeping me going, and but largely it's because they embarrass me. There's every single book of mine I know I'm going to find things that where I go, why did you have to put that in? The book would have been so much better without that poem, and it's too late, you know. And sometimes it's not. Like, I had had opportunities to fix that, where, like, doing a selection constant of my first four books, and I got a chance to rewrite some things. And that was very satisfying. And delete some things. And that, like, saved me. Like, things that really, I would wake up in the middle of the night and writhe with humiliation and embarrassment. And, like, I got a chance to kill them and, like, get rid of them, you know. Like, but I'm afraid that those are the ones I tend to notice. The good ones, I go, okay, good. And then I'll go look at the ones that embarrass me and, like, writhe, you know. Like, so that's why I don't like to do that.
Okay. The other thing relates to, like, growing as a poet and how, like the important thing is to cultivate what you're not focusing on. But it can be hard to even really notice what you're not focusing on. And that's where, like, teachers are important. But even then, it's kind of... how do you get a foothold on this thing that you're not intuitively or naturally doing?
I usually have a pretty good idea of what my strong points are. And then I can try to go the other way. But what you say about teachers, to me, one of the most wonderful things a teacher can do, and I think teaching is really just about the greatest thing that a human being can do. Many of the very greatest people in history have been teachers. What you can do, and what my best teachers did, was save me time, years, like by directing me, not telling me what to do, but like, go read this. Things that I wouldn't have known how to find. You know, I might have taken me years to come across them. So you save you time, but teachers are all. You always have teachers all through your life. You know, I always have looked for people to be teachers to me. And it's very interesting to find myself at a point where I seem to be in that position myself, you know, with younger people. I find that very humbling and very exciting, you know. Is that enough of an answer? Yeah. But I'm not quite sure I fully understand your question.
Think so. One more question. It relates to poetry and prose.
Yeah.
And how it seems to me, this may be very simplistic, but like how in poetry there's like one voice, and in prose there are like many voices. And the problem with like having many voices is that they clump together and it's hard to make it as clear.
It can be true. That could be true. That's always a big question. This question always comes up. What's the difference between poetry and prose? Eliot said prose has more words. But he was just being, you know, sarcastic. But, you know, the difference to me is that usually, I don't know about the voices thing, there can be different voices in a poem, but to me it's, poems are closer to a feeling of sort of singing, like, you know. And that, it makes sense, because lyric poetry, you know, they're lyrics. There was a time right up until, well, it even was true in the Elizabethan age, a lot of poetry was sung. They're the lyrics of songs. And certainly in the ancient world, the idea of a poem without music would have been preposterous. Like the Iliad was sung and, you know, all poetry was sung. They were the lyrics of songs. So we get the words, but no one knows what Greek music sounds like, you know. So we're missing out on half that, you know. But I don't know. Poetry to me feels like it's more a matter of what you can suggest to the reader, and less a matter of what you're going to tell the reader, you know. You give the reader credit for... You know what? I know it. This is the analogy that I use. Again, the few times I've taught. This ends up being a really... This seemed to be a useful analogy. Poems, in some ways, to me, seem like they work like jokes. They have like a punchline. It's a dark punchline, you know, an anti-punchline. But they... They work like jokes in this way. If you tell somebody a joke and explain to them why it's funny, they don't. It's not funny, is it? So think how a joke works. You're counting on the fact that the listener is going to instantaneously fill in the certain missing information that you're not saying in order to get it, you know? And a poem, I think, works in a very similar way as a joke. That's another aspect of it. But it's just generally, it's more of a form of singing. Like, it's like comparing singing and talking.
Franz, could you talk to us a little bit about winning the Pulitzer? What was the dark side of it as well as the bright side?
It was right at the start, it was like the most shocking thing that I could possibly have imagined. Like, that day, April 5th in 2004, I was in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and I cannot possibly imagine a more shocking, more unexpected, thing that had to happen. Like, they call it and you go, come on. You know it's like a friend calling you, like putting you on. They're getting somebody to do this. And you know, like, I wouldn't believe it for a while. I went, no, I didn't. You know, and then they go, yeah, you did. And then pretty soon, like, every newspaper in the world starts calling you and their phone never stops ringing, and it's frightening. And I don't know. I didn't know, because nobody had paid any really attention to me critically. I'd published, like, about 5 books and with small presses, university presses and private presses, and no one had really reviewed me very much or paid very much attention to me. I wasn't unknown, but I'd won a Guggenheim grant. I've won a lot of NEA grants and Guggenheim grants, and I published a lot in magazines, and I was known to other writers. But it takes, you go to a different. One problem for me was, I'm a very immature and disturbed person, and I do stupid things that I regret very easily. I'm constantly trying to watch that I don't, but I do. And it's like something comes out and goes, and I go, no, you're not going to do that. And it goes, yes, I am. And it does it, like, and it's too late. So for one thing, whenever I do something really stupid or be, make a fool of myself, it would be localized and I could move somewhere else. Like, now that's not possible, there's nowhere to hide anymore. It was very thrilling. The first thing I did was I went out and walked for about 2 hours, and I just thought about my dad, like how it made me feel. I sort of talked to him in a way that I hadn't for a long time, and like, what do you think of this, man? This is weird, and it was psychologically strange to. I don't know. It was thrilling, but it was fun and thrilling. But and then people say a lot of wonderful things about you, and you go, yeah. You agree with that, and then they start to. Then the other people start coming out, which they will no matter who wins. But you don't like. I know people who like Simic and Strand and different. They've been getting this critical attention from the time they were in their 30s, early mid 30s. I had no practice with this. I had no callus over myself when it came to negative, which you're going to get. As soon as you have some little degree of success, all these people are going to come out and go, his stuff isn't so hot, It's like you didn't, apply to win this prize. It even asked to. And I'm the first one. I made a list of all the poets better than me who never won it. That made me feel better. But I got a lot of, I got some, the worst, there was one, as I think some people know, there's a one, I have my nemesis, what's his name? William Logan, who who everyone kept saying to me, Franz, if he wrote a good review of you, it would be the ultimate humiliation, you know. And like because he only writes about the most successful poets to put them down, because he's a very bitter guy who's never gotten any attention for his work because it sucks. It's really bad. And so he figured at some point, if I can do it by, I can get attention. It's very childish. Like the reviews that, if you read them, they are so viciously personal. And I didn't know how to go, it's not you. It's the fact that you've become noticed, you know. It would happen to anyone. I'm a pretty fragile person in, you know, my sense of self. And easily enraged of a person, too. So I took it personally but I've gotten a lot better at it. It took a while. Like, it's been now about 5 years, and I'm pretty good, much better at it. I haven't mastered it, but I still get mad sometimes. But the thing that's so aggravating about that, though, criticism, is that, you know, I was reading with Louise Gluck, which was a staggering honor for me, and at Houston a few years ago, and somebody brought this up. What do you think about reviewing? And I just said, I knew they were baiting me and they were trying to get me, you know. And I just said, oh, well, I believe that they don't read the books they review. It's absolutely clear to me when I read a review of a book of mine that the person has spent about 10 minutes leafing through the book and hasn't read maybe half or three quarters of the poems. Because it's easy to tell, because they will say something about your work that is completely contradicted by it later in another part of the book, that you answer yourself, that you know yourself and respond to, have already responded to. And they act like it's not there. It's not there because they haven't read it, you know. And I can see that. Like, if you were like a reviewer and you get all these books every month or something and you have to write, you're not going to spend, you can't. I mean, how would you be able to, you might not even know the person's work that well. And it's a stupid, reviews are stupid. The good thing about them is that they if you get a review in a prominent journal that a lot of people see, it sells books. If you get a review in the New York Times Book Review, you don't care. They can accuse you of being a murdering children and you go look at Amazon, and on a Sunday, you know, morning or something, when the New York Times, it's happened because my editor told me, you're the only poet on our list right now who's every single one of your last four books has received a review a full page review in the New York Times Book Review, and your sale. You know, they have those sales numbers. Like, it'll be like 500,000, 200,000, and the higher the number means the worse the sales, and it goes down. The lower the number, the better the sales, and you can see it. It goes from like 700,000 to 3,000, like, you know, and it's like, whoa, it's like, you want to watch it all day, like the stock market, you want to take a picture of it, and like, mine went down to, the day I won the Pulitzer Prize, it went to 200, which is like novel stuff, you know, and like, so a lot of things happen that really boost your ego. It's like, they finally notice how wonderful I am, and like, and then you got to deal with the other, yeah, and I've learned how not to. I'm learning how not to respond. You know, I didn't know. I had no practice, and I'm very, very easily wounded. You know, like the very thin skin. You know, so that was tough.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, so we'll end there. Franz, thank you so much for your poetry and your candor and for coming to see us.
Thank you.
Let's give him another round of applause.